Well, you should have your Bible open to Proverbs chapter 2, and in these first five verses, we're going to begin examining where we are right now in our overview of the table of contents. We're at a point where between phase 1 of level 1, or that first semester, and the second semester of phase 2 of level 1, just before the son is to be receiving the words of wisdom and justice and instruction and justice and judgment and equity, right before he gets his education underway in earnest, the father first of all pauses, sits his son down, and examines him to make sure his level of commitment really matches the level of commitment the father has to giving the whole thing in the first place. And there's two major areas that's going to encompass. And one of them is your commitment to learning it in the first place. And this exhortation breaks that down into three basic issues that we'll look at. And then the rest of the exhortation is going to be dealing with the commitment that the son is to have to its effectual working. And those two things correspond to what I commonly always say when I say your sonship education. That's the first issue, the learning of it, and your sonship edification, which is the second issue, and its effectual working in you that plays out in the details of your everyday life, your workaday world, so to speak. And so that has to be probed and examined and checked off before the son really can move on to beginning to receive the instruction in wisdom and justice, judgment, and equity. So let's take a look at this now here in Proverbs chapter 2. In fact, I want to go down through the first 9 verses, then we're going to focus primarily on the first 5. Again, David instructing his son here, and this is where he is checking his son Solomon's level of commitment when he says, "My son, if thou will receive my words and hide my commandments with thee, so that thou incline thine ear unto wisdom and apply thine heart to understanding, yea, if thou criest after knowledge and liftest up thy voice for understanding, if thou seekest her as silver and searchest for her as for hid treasures, then shalt thou understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God. For the Lord giveth wisdom. Out of his mouth cometh knowledge and understanding. He layeth up sound wisdom for the righteous. He is a buckler." Hopefully you can go and find out what that older English expression means, a buckler, but that has something to do with the power of this thing to protect and to deliver you. "He is a buckler to them that walk uprightly. He keepeth the paths of judgment and preserveth the way of his saints. Then shalt thou understand righteousness and judgment and equity." And by the way, there's no coincidence that this corresponds perfectly to the next phase of your sonship education in verse 3 of chapter 1 in the table of contents. You get those very words mentioned there, receiving the instruction of wisdom, justice, and judgment and equity. "Then shalt thou understand righteousness and judgment and equity, yea, every good path." And we'll stop right there. And really, those first 5 verses form the exhortation to this first issue here of your commitment to sonship learning. It forms the exhortation to the first commitment level issue. And then verses 6 through 9 really come along and exhort the son in a little bit different way. Then in verses 10 through the remainder of the chapter, that comes along and forms the exhortation to this second level of commitment, or the second major issue of your commitment level, which is the exhortation to committing to its effectual working in your inner man, in the details of your life, in what you're learning. And the entirety of the exhortation of Proverbs, the whole chapter 2 of Proverbs, the son's commitment level to learning and to the effectual working of the doctrine, that all corresponds to the information you get in Romans chapter 8, specifically in verses 26. Remember what? Let's come over and just remind ourselves of that. Some of this exhortation, come back to Romans chapter 8, verses 14 and 15, we've discussed a little bit. That's your initial, well, in fact, just going back to, let me just throw the table of contents back up there. Romans chapter 8, 14 and 15. Oh, in fact, I've got that, don't I? Is really that first level of to know wisdom and instruction. For as many as are led by the Spirit of God, they are the sons of God. As many as receive the Spirit of bondage, we have not received the Spirit of bondage to fear, but again to fear, but you've received the Spirit of adoption, whereby we cry, Abba, Father. And then we had, you can't read this, but this is verse 16 to the end of the chapter, which really forms that second phase of phase 1, or phase 1b, to perceive the words of understanding. And then what's interesting, though, is that by the time, let me go back to this again, by the time you get to, well, I guess I want this. By the time you get down to verse, let your eyes scan down in chapter 8 down to verse 25. Verse 25 ends a section of information that talks to you about being able to reckon that the sufferings of this present time aren't worthy to be compared with the glory, and then he explains that. And in verse 21, he talks about that creature. In verses 19, 20, and 21, he talks about the creature, and you get that understanding of you have a vocation in that, you have a role to play, you have a that's what your Father's business with you is all going to be about. By the way, there's something sitting there. The creature itself is made aware of this. This is part of the mystery. The creature didn't know how it was going to get delivered until God told it and made it aware. And that was at the same time he raised up the Apostle Paul and brought this new dispensation of grace in. And that creature now has been informed of something and is waiting for the manifestation of the sons of God. That's you and me. But then you get to verse 26, and there's an interesting thing that happens here. This is 26 and 27 is where you get information about praying. And you're told pretty much that you don't really know what you're doing, but the Spirit helpeth our infirmities. We know not what we ought to pray. The Spirit maketh intercession for us with groanings that cannot be uttered. He searcheth the heart, knowing what is the mind of the Spirit, because he maketh intercession for us. Now what I'm after in that is that something is starting to come out of your mouth at this point. And you're going to see that in this exhortation. You're going to see where that fits in this exhortation. Because there's going to be a point in this first exhortation talking about your commitment to learning where you're going to cry after something. You're going to lift up your voice. And you're going to cry after. And all of that, that's part of that response that's coming from your side of the issue. And then verse 28 through the end of the chapter is actually corresponds to the information that's contained in this exhortation in Proverbs chapter 2. I'm not saying that Proverbs chapter 2 is the doctrine that we have to have, but that exhortation tells you kind of as a study aid or study guide to help you realize Paul's not just indiscriminately throwing things together here. And he doesn't throw verse 26 and 27 in randomly in the middle of talking about the creature. He's following this pattern. He's paying attention, though he's not saying it. As he's giving you the curriculum, he's actually giving you the curriculum in the exact same format or following the same form of the way a father intends for the son to be taught in the first place. And so the entirety of this Proverbs, come back to Proverbs chapter 2 now, and just realize that the commitment to learning and all of this corresponds, especially from verse 26 to the end of the chapter there in Romans 8. And it all fits into the basic establishment of level 1 of phase 1 of the son knowing wisdom and instruction and perceiving the words of understanding and then what he needs to commit to before he moves to the next thing. Well, first of all, let's first of all deal with just the first part of this. So let's take this issue and just come along and wipe the other part off for a moment, and let's just deal first of all with the commitment to learning. And what David tells Solomon in the first five verses of Proverbs 2 is designed to check out and make sure that he realizes the level of commitment to this education that his father expects him to have. David expected him to have it as his father. And God, your heavenly Father, expects you to have it as his adopted son or daughter. And again, this is going to be totally antithetical and 180 degrees off course from the way mainline Christianity is going today. Because they're going away from learning, and they're going toward medicating. All they're doing is medicating and giving you soulish experiences for 20 minutes or so, or 30 minutes or so, set in a package of it being so-called spiritual. You get pretty much the same result at a football game. You get the high, the thrill, the lows. You cry, you laugh, you scream, you get mad, you get happy. Pretty much the same gamut of emotions at any football game. Especially if you follow the Bears. But more crying than anything. But anyway, that's where this fits in. This first five verses really fits in. And it's dealing with that first part of the son's commitment to learning the education, or learning the curriculum, as found in these first five verses. Now notice, when you look at these first five verses in Proverbs 2, first of all, realize this is one entire sentence. When David begins saying to Solomon, and Solomon writes it down here, my son, comma, if you go on down through verse 1, ends in a semicolon, verse 2, semicolon, verse 3, semicolon, verse 4, ends in a semicolon, verse 5, finally, after the word God, ends in a period. It's one big long sentence, but it's broken up into all these various clauses. And so there, in fact, are three major clauses in it, and they all are easily identifiable because they all begin with the word if. There's three major if clauses. And these if clauses in the first four verses, in other words, are actually subjective clauses. Each one of them is an if. Maybe you will and maybe you won't. You're supposed to, if you will do this, if you will do this, if you will do this. Maybe you will, but maybe you won't. But it's up to your, that's what's being examined here. Your positive, proper response to each component in the exhortation. And then after all three of those if clauses, and by the way, this isn't an if-then issue under the law. This isn't an if you do this, then you'll get blessing. There are other ways to talk about, even within the world of grace, to talk about the fact that, you know, and you're talking about a commitment to an education and learning, that there's certain ways it's being done. And when you describe certain ways that things are done, if you do this, if you turn this switch and turn that dial and push that button, then it'll come on. That's not an if-then, contractual if-then, as under the law. So I just want to make sure that you don't have a snag in your thinking, well, this is putting me back under the law because it's an if-then. No, it's not contractual. These are all subjective. Maybe you will, maybe you won't. But if you want to benefit from this, this is how it's going to happen. And so the three ifs come up here. And then finally, after all three of those ifs have been dealt with and properly dealt with, after they form their they're to form a composite whole. That's why they're said in one sentence. They're all connected. They're three different clauses, but they have a composite whole that's supposed to be formed. After they've formed that, then you get your then result. So let's look at it. The first if clause is verses 1 and 2. And he says, my son, if thou will receive my words and hide my commandments with thee, so that thou incline thine ear unto wisdom and apply thine heart to understanding. The second if clause is all of verse 3. Yea. By the way, that tells you this is something increased from the first one. If thou criest after knowledge and liftest up thy voice for understanding. Thirdly, verse 4, the third if clause. If thou seekest her as silver and searchest for her as for hid treasures. Now you get your resulting then clause in verse 5. Then shalt thou understand the fear of the Lord. Now you say, well, wait a minute. Didn't I get that back in the very first exhortation in verse 7 of chapter 1? Look at chapter 1, verse 7. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. You did get that there. But it's not said the same way here. It's said slightly different because it's doing something slightly different. It's along the same lines, I'll tell you. But we'll deal with that when we come to the then. But the then clause occurs there in verse 5. And verse 5, in that verse, the terminology ought to be, again, very familiar, because we just went over that in connection with the first exhortation in that that's corresponded with the first part of phase 1 to know wisdom and instruction. And the matching aspect of that, as we saw over in Romans 8, 14 and 15, in which the Son, He gets first told by the Father all about now receiving the adoption of sons. All that's a part of your initial recognition what sonship's about, and the issue of the spirit of adoption leading you through the curriculum of your sonship education. And the very first thing the Son then makes a decision on, like I said, you've made a decision before you even get to this point. You've made a decision to commit to, actually, your first sonship decision that you had to make is whether I'm going to engage in it or not. It's like walking into a store. You're walking down the street, and I like to window shop, and I'll walk by something. You look in the store, and you may breeze by 10 stores, but all of a sudden, something catches your eye in this one window, and you have to almost back up, and you go in that store. Well, what initially happens is verses 14 and 15 in Romans 8 come along and tell you, I've adopted you as my son. I've given you my spirit of adoption. And so it's initially, your first sonship decision is whether or not you're going to engage in this, whether you want to walk in the door. Whether your first sonship decision you ever made was whether you're going to engage in your sonship or not. That was done before you even get to this point. And that's why Proverbs 1:7 comes along and begins to exhort you, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. And the beginning of your sonship education amounted to the issue whether or not you weren't just attracted by something that caught your eye. You have been told for a long, long time about something that should capture your and grab your attention. The beginning of your sonship education amounted to whether or not you had the proper amount of respect and fear of the Lord, capital L, capital O, capital R, capital L, that's Jehovah, in connection with what He wants to do with you as His son. And all of that comes from when the son gets in his childhood training out of it what he's supposed to get out of it. And one of the things, this sounds totally politically incorrect, but one of the things a son is supposed to have produced in him as a little boy is a proper amount of fear. And I don't mean fear in the sense that he is afraid of his dad, but I mean a fear in a healthy respect. And this occurs in a lot of little ways. And by the way, I want to say this caveat. I realize that some of the things I say does not personally work with you. Because when I look out over an audience like this, I know that some of, and I may not know, I don't know in most of your lives, I have no idea what your relationship with your dad was like. He may have died early in your life. He may have left. He may have been a sorry father. He may have been great. I don't know. But what I am talking about is the design and the proper way a father deals with a son. Now, I realize that's not always going to happen. And for some of you, it never did happen properly. But so I'm not trying to say these things to either be critical of you or to say something that you have no frame of reference with. But my understanding is that a child is supposed to realize when he's a little boy, you don't say that to him or you're going to get something in return. Or you don't do that or you're going to get it, whatever it is, you're going to get it. And it's that kind of fear that begins to produce something. And that's not all bad. That can be unhealthy. If it's the fear that if I say anything, my daddy's going to backhand me in the mouth, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a father who has set the boundaries, some godly boundaries, some proper boundaries in a son's life. He has discipline if that son crosses those boundaries. He has the proper amount of care and concern and love. He's much more concerned about He's more concerned that his son respect him as a father, when he's a little boy, rather than hearing "I love you, Daddy" all the time, which may be real heart plucking and tender, but means nothing. It's far better to hear have a son grab your hand and shake it like a hand ought to be shook, and look you straight in the eye when he's 35. And tell you, "I love you, Dad," and know with intelligence what he's talking about. But that begins, there is something that is destroyed in a son if his father has not produced that proper respect through discipline, through communication in many, many areas, in many, many ways. That's destroyed by a father who counts to his son. "Now, son, 1, 2, 3, and he just keeps doing it. He could be counting 1,573, 1,574. He could be counting until he's blue in the face. His son isn't going to do anything different. Or he puts him in timeout. Or he does some other goofy, politically correct thing so that the part of the psyche that son needs to have set is to have a particular kind and nature of fear in his father, because that's going to do something in him later on. And the horrible, shoddy way fathers rear children today, it's been taught to them and ingrained into them that that's wrong. That's not wrong. It can be abused and it can be horrible. But the proper attitude and the proper healthy way that is to be done lends itself to something when that son becomes a young man. When he becomes a teenager and makes the transition between being a boy and being a man, the healthy fear of his father paves the proper way and allows him to care that what my father thinks about me matters. And what my father thinks about other things matter to me. And that's born out of that healthy fear of him that got developed as a child. So that when somebody hands me a joint, or somebody hands me a crack pipe, or I walk into a dorm room where there's more marijuana smoke than air, you realize out of just simply this fear of my dad, I'm not about to do that. My dad would kill me. All right, now that's going to get refined a little later on to where you don't really think your dad's going to kill you, but that saved you from something. That saved you from making a stupid mistake, because it had a power to produce in you a reluctance to do something just for no other reason than I know my father would never, ever want me to do that. And it matters. What that produces is a caring and a mattering in that son or that girl or that daughter, that what my father thinks matters. And you often hear this from young people. I've heard it from even older people. "I've just been trying to live up to my father's expectations." And of course, that's usually out of somebody who's seeing therapists and all this kind of thing. But there is some real properness to that, that therapy is trying to jettison, that patterns itself out of sonship, proper sonship edification. And that's why the fear of the Lord is the beginning of instruction. I was saved from things like, just for that very reason. I still felt that way when my dad was 80 years old. If I let my movie at Blockbuster lapse and I didn't get it back on time, I was scared to death he'd find it out and I'd get the name speech again. And he set me down and say, "Now you know that your name is mine, it's Newbold, and that looks bad, that reflects bad on me when you're late." You know, he equated that with being late on a house payment. To him it was all the same. It's your name. You rented it. You agreed to have it back that day. You better have it back that day. I mean, it went to the, it got that, it was that. And I'm not damaged. I'm not brain damaged for that. I'm the better for it. But what I'm bringing these things out because, again, you dads, you fathers who have, still have young children, have one of the toughest jobs that there is. And it's been denigrated and is being denigrated by every kind of pressure there is today. And it's, if you want to learn how to raise a child properly, this is the way God intended it. Not just to edify you as His son, but for you to deal with yours. So the beginning of this, of your sonship, amounted to the issue of whether or not you had the proper amount of respect and fear of the Lord in connection with what He wants to do with you as His son. And that gets generated in a child in his training, his childhood training. And that's supposed to produce a fear, that sacred respect, that healthy respect for what amounts to your father's character. You respect his character and respect his reputation. This is in a proper father. Again, my caveat. I know some of you may not have had a proper father. I don't know that. I know some of you have, but what I'm after is, I'm talking about the standard of a father. And there should be this healthy respect for his father's reputation and character, because the child grows up seeing that and hearing that. I did. And this admiration other men had. There's nothing that thrills a son any more than to hear another man talk about the admiration he has for his father. And I used to get that. I'd be sitting in the yard office, and my dad would be in the railroad yard office, and my dad would be filling out his paperwork. Tim and I would be in there, and one of the things I loved to do was to go in there. If in the rare times that we would get to go in there, I would run over to where the telegrapher was, and I loved to watch the telegrapher in there. And he was fantastic. And instead of doing the Morse code just by tap, 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 he had what they called a bug. That they called it a bug, where it toggled between his index finger and his thumb. And he could send and receive Morse code so fast. I used to sit there and watch him send, and then watch as he would write it down as he was receiving it and everything. And I can remember him telling me once, he said, "You're Chet Newbold's son, aren't you?" And, you know, I was just a little toddler. And I said, "Yeah." And he would tell me something about my dad, something that he admired about him, and those little things that you hear start to generate within you this issue of, I want to be just like him. And that he becomes your hero. He becomes somebody who you become admirable of, because you see other men who are in positions of authority and power and response, and they admire him. And this character and this reputation that he has starts to get generating in your thinking that, I don't want to do anything that would sully that in his eyes. I don't want to be a fool in his eyes. And this is exponentially huge by the time you get to Romans chapter 8, verse 14, because you've had from Romans 1:1 to Romans 8:13 that has developed that whole issue in your mind by now. Where you now, you have an admiration for what your Heavenly Father did. He took His very begotten Son. And he put Him on a cross. And He crucified Him. And He bore my sins on that cross. And He did more than just justify me permanently. He also sanctified me. He made it so I could be dead to sin, alive unto God, alive unto my Father, which is needful before I even learned I was His son. And He has provided a way for me to be able to deal with sin in my life, and to walk after the Spirit, and to mind the things of the Spirit. He has given me His Spirit, and His Spirit dwells in me. And all of these things, all I'm saying is that all of that, those things that get seen by a child, are things that he sees other adults admire. And that causes the child desire to want to measure up to his father, so to speak. He wants to measure up in his eyes. He doesn't want to be a fool in his eyes. And for us, we're not, like I say, we never were spiritually, as members of the body of Christ, we were never children in that sense. In the sense of being under the tutor and governor system of the law. That never was the way it was with us. We were, however, Paul will use language to describe that. He'll talk about us as being babes. We were babes, so to speak, in our appreciation for all our Father had done for us when He justified and sanctified us. And like I said, all of Romans 1:1 through Romans 8:13 should have produced a healthy, sacred respect and appreciation for our Father's character. So by the time we're informed of our being adopted as sons in Romans 8:14 and 15, that, coupled with what we've already come to appreciate about Him, produces a fear, which is a respect for His character that we admire, that we care about, that matters to us greatly. If not, you're nuts. You would have to be insane not to be greatly in admiration of a God who has provided all that you have been informed about from Romans 8:1 to 8, or Romans 1:1 to 8:14. You just have to be nuts not to have that generated in you, so that you it greatly matters how you're viewed by Him. You see, all of this is worked exactly in the same format that it's worked for a son, even in the book of Proverbs. And that should also happen with real fathers. I mean, you as a father, and your, with your sons and your daughters. Well, all that does is to produce in you an understanding that the most sensible thing to do, and by the way, I use that expression not indiscriminately, because that's kind of what will come up in Romans 12, 1 and 2. It's going to be your reasonable service. If it's unreasonable, if somebody does things that are unreasonable, you're at a football game and it's 0 out. Maybe you're not there, but you're watching one on TV in Green Bay and it's 0. And there's these guys in the stands that rip their shirts off and they have painted Go Packers all the way down their on their chest. Now, ask yourself, is that reasonable? You'd say, no, that's rather unreasonable given the conditions. And you might put it in a little bit different terms than that. You might say, those guys are nuts. That's what you're supposed to perceive. I'd be nuts. I'd be stupid. You're supposed to understand the most sensible thing to do, the most logical thing to do, is to go along with this education now. That is, you'd be a fool, you'd be stupid not to do this. You'd be one of the stupidest people on the face of the earth not to want to commit to learning this and commit to your sonship education. But now, the initial fear of the Lord, that has to grow a little more now. Because you've been informed now of some other things by now. You've gone through the first phase of this. You've come to know wisdom and instruction and perceive words of understanding. You've been told, the carrot's been given to you, dangled out there, what your vocation is going to be with your Father. And that fear now has to grow a little more, and that's why it's revisited here. That's why you have to move right on from knowing wisdom and instruction to perceiving words of understanding. And one of the things that dawns on you at that point is that this education my Father wants to give me isn't going to happen in 5 minutes. This isn't going to happen in a series of 7 lessons in a week-long tent service somewhere. This isn't going to happen quickly. And that alone tells you there's going to have to be a lot of commitment to this. In fact, you either have come or you are just now coming along to the point where you realize this is going to take the rest of my life. This is going to be a lifelong endeavor of being educated and edified as my Father's son and my Father's daughter. You're right. That's what your life is for. And that's exactly the point where you'd also need to realize this is going to require a high degree of commitment out of you in order to get all that is designed for you to get and purposed for you to get within it. So the issue right now for us is that when you're confronted with those first 3 ifs in verses 1 through 4 here in Proverbs chapter 2, Now, when you've dealt with them and processed them in your mind, and they all effectually work within you to the point where you come along and make the decision as to whether you're going to commit yourself to it or not, when you do commit to it, to the level that's described here in those first four verses, verse 5 comes along and says, "Then shalt thou understand the fear of the Lord." And that understanding is not in that initial fear produced by your young childhood training, but it's understanding in view of the rest of what it takes to get all that's built into this curriculum and all that's into the sonship education and get all of that out of it. So it's taking that initial fear and boosting it up now. And the first aspect of understanding the fear of the Lord is to simply understand that this education is something that I desperately want. I need it due to my father. My father's excited. He's exuberant. And his main desire is to give it to me. And I want it. This is something I want. Now the issue is, once that's settled, what does it take for me to get it? And it's going to take something commensurate with what the Father did in putting it out. And there was work involved in putting it out. A lot of work. And there's work involved in getting it. And again, as soon as I say amen today, in 99.9% of the churches in this country, I'd be met at the door by the Board of Deacons and fired before sundown. Because they're not going to stand to work. But that's what it's going to take. That's, by the way, why a pastor who does his job properly is a workman. It takes work. And that's why we need to... That's why we did what we did Tuesday. Why I went and spent 30 or 40 minutes going back to 1 Timothy chapter 4 and we looked at that exercise issue. What do you think exercise is? There were words in there. Paul told Timothy that he's going to attain to things. When you attain to something, you work for it. And the work involved in it, the exercise involved in it to attain unto something, there's a lot of work involved in exercise. You look at anybody doing it. They don't sweat because they're sitting there doing nothing or perspire. Especially physical exercise. In fact, one of the most often used expressions when you're talking about going to exercise, you don't say that. You don't say, "I'm going down to exercise, dear. I'll see you in about an hour." What do you say you're going to do? Yeah, work out. That's why it's called a workout. There's work involved. So this really is an increased aspect of the initial fear of the Lord, where the son is now to realize and have a healthy respect for how much the Father put into this and how much it's going to take for him to get out of it. And there's actually three measures to your commitment to sonship learning. And in fact, this isn't the exact same thing as was dealt with in the first exhortation in chapter 1, verse 7. Coupled with the fact that there's going to be these other three measures to your commitment, that's why verse 5 doesn't just end with the comma. Verse 5 doesn't just come along and say, it doesn't just end there by saying, "Then shalt thou understand the fear of the Lord," period. But it goes on to say, "and find the knowledge of God." It's stated different because it's doing something different. And it's going to take the appropriate commitment to the son's learning in order to find that knowledge of God. And by the way, that's not find in the sense of, I don't know where it's located type finding. We know where it's located. Here's the book. You've got the manual. So you know where it's located. In fact, it's more than that. It's found for us. Our curriculum is Romans through 2 Thessalonians, specifically Romans through Philemon, the letters of the Apostle Paul overall. It's not finding it in the sense of where the words are located in the Bible. In fact, that's not what the end of verse 5 is referring to at all. Not even in Israel's program are they coming along scratching their head wondering, where are the words? It's a find. When you find the knowledge of God, it's finding it in the sense of getting that knowledge that's in the curriculum and contained in all the various forms of doctrine that it takes, that as the table of contents outlines, as you go through the three levels of your sonship life, as you're led by the Spirit through that curriculum in the proper order, in its sense and sequence, as you pay attention to the methodology of get it, it's a find in the sense of becoming acquainted with it. I know where the words are, but I need to find it in the sense of obtaining it and receiving the education. It's a find of receiving the knowledge of God, the curriculum of the sonship edification. But like I said, to just finish off today, we need to focus our attention upon the three measures that are contained here and accounted for here. And I use that term measure very carefully because that's what we're doing. We use that word in a couple of different ways, but I think it's such a powerful word when we're talking about this. There are three measures, because it's not only three different things, and since I've already used the number one up here, and I might have to use numbers here, I'm not going to use them, but I'm not going to follow this, and you know me well enough to know if I don't follow a outline format of numbers and letters and caps and small case and everything, you don't care. But they are measures. They're not only three different categories, but they're also measuring you. They're taking don't you hate it when they actually, the worst part of like getting a suit is when that guy puts that tape around your waist. Whoa. Especially if something like that comes out. I never liked that when he'd measure my waist and go, or, ooh. But that's what it's going to do. It's going to measure you in those places you'd rather not be measured. So these are three measures to your commitment to sonship learning. And in fact, this isn't the exact same thing, like I said, that we've dealt with in the first exhortation, but it's going to come along and measure your commitment, and it's going to identify what that commitment is and what these three things, what this measure of commitment consists of. And the first measure of commitment is found there in verses 1 and 2. My son, if thou wilt receive my words and hide my commandments with thee, so that thou incline thine ear. Notice there's a, you'll notice just by the virtue of the fact that verses, that first if spans two verses, it's almost like, and you've got a so then that begins verse 2, it's like, there's two parts to this. If thou wilt receive my words and hide my commandments with thee, so that thou incline thine ear unto wisdom and apply thine heart unto understanding. The second measure is found in verse 3. If thou criest after knowledge and liftest up thy voice for understanding. By the way, the yea there tells you you've got an increase here. It's kind of like that first level of commitment is the most fundamental one of all. If you don't have that, and we're going to see that. In this first measure of commitment, if you don't have that, you might as well just go home. Oh, Harley Melton would say, just get a cake of soap and hit the showers, because you're done. The rest of it's it's going to be meaningless. And that's the way it's written, and that's the way it's designed to be taken. If you don't have that, just forget it. But that first one isn't sufficient enough to get everything out of this curriculum, because your level of commitment, well, it's not full yet. It's got to be full. And it's kind of like you've only got one third of what you need. So the second measure comes along and says what it says, and it increases it by that yea. And then the third measure of commitment is all of verse 4. If thou seekest her as silver and searchest for her as for hid treasures. So you've got if this, and if this, and if this, then. Then you'll understand what it takes to get this, if you properly respond to it, and you'll end up getting that knowledge. Well, the first measure of commitment there in verses 1 and 2, we'll begin talking about next time, but let's just erase the bottom of this now, and we'll go to that. We'll just put, so you can go home and think about this, and this would be a great place to stop and a great place for you to start engaging yourself in whatever time you can give to this between now and Tuesday night. He says, "My son, if thou will receive my words and hide my commandments with thee." Now he's putting the emphasis on what you're doing, and you're going to be receiving the words, hiding them with you, so that thou incline thine ear unto wisdom. When you incline your ear to something, and I'll do this from time to time when I'm sitting, I don't know what it is, there's certain programs that come on that I don't know what they do to my television, to the sound in it, but they sound like they're in a tunnel. And so I'm trying to do this very indiscriminately so my wife doesn't see it, but now she's going to know. But I will, sometimes you'll have your arm up above your head, I will push this ear out like this, and I'm inclining my ear to it. And not only, when you incline your ear to something, are you wanting, you want to hear this, but there's two things going on. You want to hear it, and you are shutting other things out. Suddenly, other things are no longer the priority. You now are concentrating on one thing, you are inclining to hear it, and you are purposely shutting out other things. What is that doing? That's restructuring your life, at least for that moment. And really, all of those expressions, and apply thine heart to understanding. That's the effort of making the, taking that and making sure that that is something that you understand in your inner man. And all I can say about this right now, because we're out of time, is that when you look at verses 1 and 2 there, when he's talking about, all right, you've already agreed to be my son, and you have this first initial healthy respect for my character and what I think about you, and that's good. You have an initial fear of the Lord. That's going to begin your knowledge. But to build that up now, after you've come to know wisdom and instruction, its value and its worth, and you've perceived, you see the personal usefulness of the words of understanding. Now, my son, your part in this is to commit to it when you show up. And when you what's really being described here in this first measure of commitment, what's really being described is I think very simply put, the Father's focusing the attention not just upon you attending the class, but that it's honest attendance. And I think everything, go home and look at verses 1 and 2 carefully and see if they don't line up to the issue that the first thing that son's going to get confronted with is not just him showing up to Bible class or showing up to his father's sessions when his father's going to teach him. The father will appoint a time. He'll set aside a time, and he'll say, this is the time for you and me when I'm going to talk to you and teach you and exhort you. But there's a whole lot of difference. And you know this, because it happens from kindergarten all the way to postgraduate school. You can show up to a class and be mentally somewhere else. And by the way, I'm not talking about either, when we go through this, I'll say it again, I'm not talking about that there won't be times when that happens. There will be. You may come here and you're ill. Out of sheer fear at Vandercook, we were told we would almost be taken out and executed by our band director, Vic Zajac, and we believed he could do it. We believed that there was a secret room in school that nobody got to see where he took you. And he wanted you to show up if you had a 105-degree fever and were sick. If you had the flu, you were to show up to band. And I got the flu while I was up there. I didn't have that high of a temperature, but I had about 102 fever, sick as a dog. And I was sick for every class, but I went to band. I took my saxophone out. I sat in my chair. I didn't even put my reed on it. I sat there and had it right now like this for an hour, got up, put it away, and then went back to bed. But I didn't miss that class. Now, I don't think that's exactly a healthy thing to do. But I realize there's going to be times where you're going to come here and you're going to be tired. You're going to be sick. You may be ill or getting ill. You may, but that's not the rule. That's the exception. What I'm talking about is when you're here, one of the things a son is going to have to commit to is that when he's here, he is there attending with honesty of heart. Let me show you just one passage. By the way, Paul is going to describe someone who attends with dishonesty of attendance in his letters. He describes somebody that way. And it's not a very pretty thing. And we'll see that. But let me just show you. Come over to Luke chapter 8. I want to show you that that expression that I use is not one of my own, but I pick it up. Actually, it's terminology from the Lord Jesus Christ himself. I'm talking about honesty in heart of attendance. When you're here with real honesty of heart, you're not just attending because I think my Father wants me there. That won't work. You got to be there because I want this as much as He wants to give it. I want it. You don't just show up because you think, well, my Father wants me there, so I better go. That won't work. That's dishonest attendance. And you'll never be educated properly. You might as well stay home. Jesus used the expression honesty of heart. He's teaching here in one of his parables, a very famous one about the sower, when he uses it, and I don't have time to set this, but I just wanted to point it out. Come down to verse... He's talking about the way the seed falls and everything. And come down to verse 15 is the verse for time's sake. But that on the good ground are they which in an honest and good heart, having heard the word, keep it and bring forth fruit with patience. By the way, it's interesting that fits fairly well with sonship. But that's where I get the expression honesty of heart, an honest and good heart. And the first thing the son has to commit to is not just simply showing up, but that he has honesty in attendance. And beginning on Tuesday night, I want to explore that a little bit. In fact, each one of these three that we're going to look at, I want to explore in some detail and make sure that you realize what I'm talking about, what that commitment level demands. But the first thing it demands is honest attendance. That you are receiving those words, you are inclining your ear and applying your heart to the understanding. And that's all bespeaks of not just the son's attendance in his father's sessions, but that he's there honestly. He has honesty of heart when he's doing it. So we'll take a look at this in more detail beginning on Tuesday.